Today on Speaking of Place, I have the great honor of talking with activist and educator Jesse Hagopian about his new book, Teach Truth: The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. We talk about the onslaught on public education that takes the form of criminalizing the truth itself. We note both the powerful corporate forces behind this movement and what they are afraid of, and also discuss the many instances of people fighting back to name, amplify, and mobilize the truth together. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. So thank you for spending time with us. Could you tell us something about the genesis of this book?
Absolutely. It really was born out of the struggle against what I call truth crime laws in the book. Laws began proliferating around the country to ban ideas, to ban knowledge, to censor anti-racist teaching, to censor teaching about gender and sexuality. And I couldn't sit back and just watch these occur and see my colleagues under attack for teaching the truth about American history. And so it began with me organizing to fight against these attacks. And so in my capacity with the Zen Education Project, and also I work with Black Lives Matter at School, and I helped to bring those organizations together to launch the first Teach Truth Day of Action in 2021. And it was an eruption of struggle all around the country. We saw educators and students and parents organize events to push back against these truth crime laws, organizing historical walking tours and speak outs and different events to teach the truth about Black history, Indigenous history, histories of people of color, and seeing that widespread opposition to these laws that wasn't making the mainstream media, I knew I had to tell their story. And so I began writing the book that summer after I got a contract with Haymarket Books, and I didn't really know where it was going to take me. I knew I had to support this struggle and push back against these laws, but I didn't know exactly what story I wanted to tell. And it shifted dramatically for me that summer when my dad discovered which plantation our family had been enslaved on. And that drew this history much closer to me and made me feel and understand the stakes of this struggle in a different way.
It's such a powerful story that you tell. And you made various attempts to get back. And it was a struggle because COVID, this and that and the other thing. But you finally made it. And I was so glad to have you read the letter to your ancestors here at Stanford, which is just an amazing document. Could you please honor us with reading that?
Yeah. So as soon as my dad found out which plantation our family had been enslaved on, we knew we had to get down to Mississippi and stand on that land and see what messages it told us. So we bought tickets to go down, and then the Delta variant of COVID surged and we had to cancel our trip. And then my dad had a stroke and that set us back some time. And then I got COVID, which turned into long COVID. So we had to keep delaying it. And my brother has a severe fear of flying. And so he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to come at all. But eventually, we all just decided we couldn't wait any longer. We all were dealing with health challenges, but we were just being called so clearly. And it was a life-changing experience to go down to Mississippi to find the land. We were in touch with a man who grew up in Morgantown, Mississippi, and who had taken it upon himself to become the town historian. This is an extremely small town. It's unincorporated. There is no stores or businesses at all. So it's hard to navigate or know where you're at. So we were very lucky to find this man online who could show us exactly where the plantation had stood and introduce us to the man who currently owns the land, who first thing that man did was go find these bricks in the wood and bring them to us and tell us these bricks were made by your ancestors. There's a kiln back in the woods that has disintegrated, but there's still shards of brick there. And to hold something that was created by our enslaved family members, it's hard to explain the kind of connection that I felt, the kind of healing that was like, this experience was real. This connected me to them. And that was intensified when he brought us to the gravesite where my ancestors were enslaved. And he had kept that gravesite clean, and there was one headstone left. And while he was away, we conducted a ceremony to honor our ancestors there. And I wrote a letter to our ancestors that I read aloud at the gravesite. Beloved ancestors, many obstacles have been placed in the way of us returning to the land where you were enslaved, abused, and forced to work to enrich the white Lenoir enslavers. The pandemic, a stroke, a fear of flying, and long COVID delayed our journey here. Before that, the education system withheld any knowledge of where you came from, the cruelty you endured, or the creativity and beautiful resistance you contributed to the world. The system of white supremacy used many tactics to deceive us and prevent our family from making this pilgrimage to where you were held captive and denied manumission. Despite the many obstacles and the plots to hide this place from us and deny us knowledge of this land and your existence here, we have found it. Your family has returned to claim you. We have returned to the forced enslaved labor camp that was politely referred to as the Lenoir Plantation. We have returned to the place where you no doubt spent endless hours picking cotton and tobacco with the promise of the lash if you slowed down or refused. We have returned to the site of unspeakable horrors. But we have also returned to the place where you all dared to live. A place where you all have the incredible courage to love, despite knowing that falling in love could inflict a terrible pain when your beloved was sold away or worked to death. We are here. We are at the very place where you found ways to guard your humanity from those who thought it was possible to steal. We are here where you sang together, granted forgiveness to a friend who hurt your feelings, dressed the wounds of those who were injured, and held those in need of comfort. We are here to experience a truth deeper than any that can be understood intellectually. We are here to make a promise to you, to this land, and to each other. You will not be forgotten. It doesn't matter if they pass laws to make it illegal to speak of you, to teach about you, or learn about you, because those laws don't govern us. Only truth and love govern us. And so we will pass on the knowledge of this land and your existence here to our posterity and to all who we encounter. We send you our deepest gratitude for gifting us the will to survive and the spirit of resistance that you passed to us through your blood and through your stories. With eternal love, Jesse, Jamana, and Gerald.
Wow. I really can't thank you enough for A, writing it, and B, reading it. And when you and I met, we talked a little bit about music too, and a famous song, "See That My Grave Is Kept Clean." And it's such a powerful instance about the discovery of the truth. I was struck by the way it brought new knowledge into the world in a deeply personal and communal manner. And also importantly, and you mentioned it very briefly, the power to heal. You have a whole chapter in the book about healing. Could you talk about healing and education a little bit? Because I think it's such a powerful instance right then.
Yeah. Absolutely, because so much violence is done in the classroom, so much intellectual violence, what Professor Henry Giroux calls the violence of organized forgetting, where our stories are erased. And I felt that violence as a student in the public school system, not seeing myself reflected in my curriculum. Certainly, Black history was marginalized, the stories of my enslaved ancestors erased. Knowledge about Africa, pre-colonial African societies, was distorted or non-existent in my curriculum. And that created a lot of self-doubt and underconfidence and really trauma. And then on the other side of my family, there was no record of a genocide that was perpetrated against my Armenian ancestors. My great-grandfather was in Armenia. His family was massacred in the Armenian genocide by the Turks, and he fled and came to the United States. And that genocide was denied by the United States until just a couple years ago. Can you imagine how horrified people would be if Holocaust denial was official policy of the United States? And yet, over a million Armenians were killed surrounding the events in World War I, and that was completely denied. So students are harmed every day when their culture, when their histories are denied. And so we have to talk about how we heal from that. And that's really what this idea of the radical healing of organized remembering is all about in my book. And I credit Sean Ginwright, who's an incredible youth worker and author, who developed this idea of radical healing. And I wanted to extend that to really focus on the power of learning our past as part of radical healing, recovering the stories that have been whitewashed out of the corporate textbooks, recovering the stories that are illegal to tell in so many states now is healing for students, because historical trauma is real. And when you don't know the traumas that were inflicted on your ancestors, then it's hard to understand the trauma that you're dealing with right now. And so I give examples in the book of how both teaching about honest history, about the struggles for liberation, can be healing to students in the classroom, but also when social movements recover the lessons of the past. Yeah. And apply those lessons and struggles today, it can be deeply healing for the people who participate in those social movements.
Yeah. As you were speaking, I was thinking about the lesson that you have about SNCC organizing. Now, if you had this problem, how would you approach it? And working through exactly these things. But stepping back one moment, you mentioned the Holocaust. In Germany, post-war, they were very clear about German guilt. And so throughout major German cities, there are memorials to this is where we did this and that. Ironically, now they're completely backtracking in terms of Palestine, but let's leave that there. But when you talk about these amazing national days of action and going to our local areas and pointing out things that we pass by every day without noticing. For example, here in San Bruno, there's a Tan Phran racetrack, which, as you point out, that's where they interned Japanese Americans. So what we're doing is looking at real physical history, and it's so much like you're going back to the plantation and re-narrating something that has been made it invisible. We just pass by, we normalize it, we say, no, they can't take away this physical, and they'll try to, and they'll plow it under and whatnot. But exactly social movements and individuals like the guy who's still keeping up the grave. This is what's so powerful about acting together based on personal commitments and personal trauma and healing both individually and collectively. And we can stitch together all these benefits and gifts and connect it. One would think it would be a model of education and knowing to be embraced by all, but your book spends some time explaining how sadly that's not the case. Can we talk more about this tidal wave of oppression and censorship that we're witnessing today? If it was bad in 2020, my God, what's happening now?
Yeah, we are at a crisis point with the attack on honest education. Today, almost half of all students go to a school where it's illegal for their teacher to teach the truth about U.S. history. So we're dealing with a situation where almost half of public school students are in classrooms where their teacher is mandated to lie to them about Black history, right? About LGBTQ plus identities, about all sorts of historical facts that relate to structural racism and its impact on communities of color. And this was the case before Trump was reelected. So now with Trump's reelection, he has issued executive orders to defund schools now that teach the truth. And this has a chilling effect. So even if not a single school is defunded, and they are likely to be defunded, but even if that doesn't occur, the chilling effect that it has, it is really a problem. Already, 2 out of 3 teachers have reported changing their curriculum and shying away from discussions about race or gender or sexuality out of fear. And they are attacking teachers. Those fears are not unfounded. A study by the Washington Post in 2022 showed that 160 teachers had either been fired or pushed out of the classroom across the United States for teaching about race or gender. And we know that was probably a low number. And since 2022, there have been countless more teachers. So it only takes one teacher in your region, in your state, where you hear that they taught honestly about Black history before you think twice about assigning that novel by James Baldwin. And those are the stories I'm hearing and that I tell in the book. I interviewed educators all across the country who are both fighting back and also seeing colleagues put that book back on the shelf or eliminate that part of their curriculum that would help kids better understand oppression in the United States.
The censorship gets to the very heart of the educational process because you don't have to agree with people, right? You can have a book out there and you can have a reasonable debate, and this is what free speech is supposed to be all about. So these right-wingers are doing more than simply suppressing things. They are obliterating the entire project of education.
I mean, you know what's so ironic is they scream to the high heavens about cancel culture, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They say that's the main problem with the United States, and yet they are the quickest to cancel any book or any educator that expresses an idea that they disagree with.
Yeah, and they won't even debate it. That's what's really despicable, right? The erasure is so violent. And so I wanted to ask you 2 things. One is, A, what are they afraid of? What's really driving this? And B, as you point out in your book, you tell us follow the money. So you can take those 2 parts and meld them or else take them separately, whatever you want. But they're so important.
Yeah, I think there's 3 main reasons behind their attack on honest education. The first one is the only one that gets discussed popularly in the mainstream media, and that is the elections, right? They want to whip up fear that white kids are being shamed at school by anti-racist teachers and use that as a method for driving their base to the polls into elections. And we saw the CRT scare was a major feature of the 2022 midterm elections. And then again, with the presidential election, the attack on critical race theory and DEI has become a centerpiece of the GOP's reelection strategy. And there's no doubt about that. But the drive to pass these laws has much more fundamental origins than that. The second major reason they are passing these truth crime laws is their belief in privatizing all public goods. And so part of driving families out of the public schools, saying that the public schools are indoctrinating their kids with race theories, is to then bring those families into charter schools or voucher programs, yep, so that they can eliminate one of the last publicly funded goods for all people in this country. They've privatized so much more, so many other sectors of the United States, and this neoliberal ideology has yet to fully destroy public education, but that is their goal.
Yeah.
And that's very scary. We have to organize and defend public education, even as we want to transform it and make it liberatory. But the final goal I think they have in this drive for truth crime laws is around what Boaventura de Sousa Santos called epistemicide. Yeah. And this is really the drive to murder knowledge, to eliminate whole systems of thought that challenge colonialism, that challenge capitalism, that challenge white supremacy. They want to eliminate methods of analyzing society, just critical race theory, such as Black studies or ethnic studies. These modes of thought are a threat to those in power, and they want to further confuse and disorganize people in the struggle for racial justice. And that became an urgent project for them in 2020. This isn't an abstract idea, because the 2020 uprising for Black lives was the largest in U.S. Yep. history. Yep. The New York Times talked about some 20 million people took the streets in every state in the country. If you'll remember, the New York Times bestseller lists were all anti-racist yeah. titles, right? This was a fundamental threat to those in power, the richest 1% who have used white supremacy to maintain yep. their rule. And they wanted to eliminate systems of thought that could challenge their power. And that's why in the chapter I call The Political Economy of Truth Crime, I detail who these billionaires are that are funding these truth crime laws.
Yeah, yeah.
And they like to paint it as a grassroots parent.
Exactly. Oh my God. Yeah.
Like that Moms for Liberty was just concerned mothers wanting to stick up for their kids. And in fact, it's all about Republican Party operatives tied to billionaires who spread this ideology and what I call parent truth crime associations across the country.
Yeah. It's not only killing systems of thought that might challenge the hegemonic ways of looking at the world, it's also effective. It's how we feel about other people in the world. And when you substitute love and care and mutual respect and all the things that came up rather organically in 20 with the George Floyd demonstrations, you have to kill that. You can't have people really relating to each other on the streets together, marching along, sharing stories, sharing food. That's what human life is about. And what they want to put in its place is absolute fear. You cannot trust anybody but us. We have your back. That's what's so insidious.
I mean, even the word inclusion now, labeled as radical subversion, right? Yeah. So just thinking about being an inclusive institution or an inclusive society mm-hmm. where you love your neighbor and support each other now is under suspicion and is cause for dismissal or attack. This has gotten completely out of control. It's the type of proto-fascist ideology
that is really chilling. Yeah, and they transcode it from institutions to bureaucracies. These heavy-handed communistic bureaucracies are crushing our spirit. It's such an inversion of the truth. As you say, they commit their own crimes against the truth. So I want to sort of pivot into what the hell's happening with the Democrats, A, and then tell us about teachers' unions, because I wanted to look at different responses to this.
Yeah. So the response of Democrats to the Republicans' attacks has been anemic, and it is really shameful. And many are surprised that the Democrats have been so feeble in standing up for honest education. But if you follow the money and you see who funds the Democrats, you find out that both parties are funded by billionaires, mostly white billionaires who like the status quo. It's working quite well for them, and yep, they don't want millions of kids to learn about the fact that their wealth was built from enslaved African labor and from the genocide of indigenous people. That doesn't benefit them at all, right? And yeah, Democrats largely oppose all of the book bans and some of the most egregious aspects of these truth crime attacks, but they do so very quietly. If yeah, they're asked, they'll say they oppose them. They've never reached out to us to help build the Teach Truth Day of Action. Imagine if the Democratic Party decided to build a day of action across the country to oppose book bans. We're talking about tens of millions of people would flood the streets and these bans would be done, right? But that's not in their interest. So they don't help support grassroots efforts to allow people to read books. That would challenge their billionaire corporate funders. Bill Gates, who has invested untold amounts of money to promote standardized testing in schools and to promote charter schools and privatization of our schools, he has invested countless hours in education, and now all of a sudden he's silent on the key issues of education, on major debate about, can our students learn Black history? They banned AP African American history in Florida and several other states. In Florida, the official state curriculum states that slavery was of, quote, personal benefit to Black people. And where are these people who were so concerned about education, like Bill Gates, right? All of a sudden, as Diane Ravitch has pointed out, and as I quote her in the book saying, he's nowhere to be found. And that's because these sort of ideas don't benefit him.
It's funny. There was a post on Blue Sky, interview with Hakeem Jeffries, who's one of my most hated people in the world. And they ask him, do you think that Democrats might be a little bit more progressive about some things? And his response was, no, we are the party of common sense. We get things done. And then the person responds, what have you done?
Exactly.
The idea is these buzzwords are supposed to.
No, what have you done except for help to usher fascism into this country? Their failure to deliver economic prosperity, their failure to lift up people from poverty, their failure to defend honest education has driven millions of people to the polls for the GOP and has allowed the rise of Trump. And that's shameful.
When you were saying those things, economic health and all this, I said, they don't even talk a good game. They won't even use the language because they think maybe these people would ask us to actually follow up on this stuff. Kamala Harris said nothing about an economic program. Trump gave her this huge opening about, I have an idea for a plan about healthcare. That was such a golden opportunity. She had nothing, which meant that it's just a signal of how complacent they are. But let's talk about teachers' unions and signs of people taking power into their own hands.
Teachers' unions at their best are an incredible force that can help transform our society to make it more equitable. And I really wish that all of the left would understand the centrality of the struggle for education and supporting educators' unions. And I'll start with that and then get more specific about the union. I think that there are so many ways that we're under attack right now. Trump is attacking trans people. He's attacking immigrants, migrants. He is attacking Palestinians and wanting to ethnically cleanse Gaza. He is attacking education. You name an area of our society and it is under attack from him. And so this can be very disorienting to everybody and to the left, where it's like, where do we start? How do we begin to build a fight back and a social movement that can challenge Trump and stop his blitzkrieg? There are so many places that we can put our energy in, but I would argue that the place where we'll get the most return is organizing in education. And I say that because, number one, these truth crime laws are broadly opposed by majorities of people in the United States. Book bans are wildly unpopular. There's a broad basis of support. Education brings together tens of millions of people who are very concerned about what is taught in the schools. We're talking about millions of students, tens of millions of parents and educators. And teachers' unions are the biggest in the country. Educators are the most unionized workforce in the nation. And when you put all that together, you're talking about people who are discussing and debating ideas, mm-hmm. who have so much in common and have common interests. And if the left took education as seriously as the right does, we have a major uprising in this country that can push back on Trump around trans issues because schools serve trans students that he is trying to demonize. It can push back against his anti-immigration policies because he has now made it clear that ICE agents can raid schools. And we can push back against those policies and his education policies. And the teachers' unions can play a huge role. We have a democratic organization that is in every school building, right? There are places in the South where unions have been kept out by quote unquote right to work laws. But even those states often have associations and groups of teachers that are networked and organized. And we saw their power during the Red State Revolt when in places that might not have been unionized or only had associations that could not collectively bargain, they shut down the entire school systems in states like West Virginia. Hmm. And in those states, Republican legislatures were in charge. They dominated the states. And those Republican legislatures vowed never to raise taxes for any reason. And yet, because teachers shut the school system down, they had no choice but to raise taxes on the rich to pay for education. And that Red State Revolt was an indication of how powerful teachers' unions can be. It spread throughout the South and then helped inspire strikes in California and in my home state of Washington as well. So when teachers' unions get organized, when they get focused on struggles for social justice, not just for raising the wages of educators, which is needed and deserved, but also for fighting against truth crime legislation, also for fighting for our immigrant youth, we can draw in masses of people from the community into a common struggle. And that kind of social justice, social movement, union approach to organizing, that is where we have power as ordinary working class people in this country. When we can fuse the power of social movements in the streets with the economic power that unions have, then we can actually shut their system down and challenge their economic power, challenge the billions of dollars that they have. And that's where I would like to see us move as an education justice movement, as social movements begin to fuse the power of those movements with the union movement. And we're seeing some revival of the union movement, both the fights in Chicago around their contract that is going on right now. The UAW stand-up strike was incredible. The organizing campaigns in Starbucks and Amazon have been big. And the idea that's been put out by the UAW for a general strike in 2028. A lot of unions are now trying to get their contracts to all expire in 2028 so that so many unions, from educators to auto workers to baristas, Amazon workers, all have their contracts come up at the same time. And now we're talking about economic power that could challenge the 1%.
Yeah, and I want us not to forget the enormous burgeoning of graduate student worker unions across the United States. It's been amazing. Again, one of the things I really appreciate about the book is the immense range of scale, from mass movements to really intimate and personal accounts. And I was thinking about when you're talking about book bans, that you mentioned that the Brooklyn Public Libraries had an unbanning the book kind of thing. Talk about that, because that was so cool. So many of us, that's our first contact with education, is in the summer, it's too hot to go outside. You go to the public library, you curl up with the book. Talk about what the Brooklyn Public Library did about the book bans.
Yeah, it was visionary and courageous. Brooklyn Public Library made their book collection open to every student in the country as a way to push back against book bans, so that students in locales where truth crime laws had been passed, where books had been banned, could access their collection. In Tennessee, books about Ruby Bridges, the elementary school student who was one of the first to integrate a school in New Orleans, were being banned. Books about Martin Luther King, Moms for Liberty wants to ban books about Martin Luther King, about Ruby Bridges, and the book Mouse about the Holocaust, yeah. Graphic novel about the Holocaust. What an outrage. So that was a courageous and important step that also inspired my hometown. The Seattle Public Library also followed suit and made collection open to the public. And one teacher took advantage of this. I believe her name was Summer, and she was teaching in Oklahoma. And when the laws came down saying that they had to limit what they were teaching about race and gender, the school district issued a directive that they had to pull all the books from their classroom libraries until they were reviewed, right? Mm-hmm. So teachers were covering all of their bookshelves with butcher paper so the kids couldn't see their titles until they were approved by the what we could call the Ministry of Truth. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this teacher had a stroke of genius, and she covered her shelf with red butcher paper. But then she wrote on it, "Definitely don't scan this QR code," and put up a QR code to the Brooklyn Public Library collection.
So cool. Wow. Yeah, as you see, it's the imagination that people have that I think is going to save us ultimately. One thing I really appreciate about having activists on the podcast is you all are so busy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bundle my last three questions, and then you can take as much time as you think you have, okay? Oh. A, I'd love to hear more about the next day of action, which is going to be in June.
Yes.
B, tell us about the Zen Education Project, because I want to drive people to the website and support you. And the last thing is, what would you say to a young teacher today? Okay, so those are the three big ones. Yeah.
Nice. Great questions. Yeah, the fifth annual Teach Truth Day of Action is coming up. And the official day is June 7th, but we're encouraging rolling actions. People can do a series of actions on the way to June 7th to participate. And we have so many ways to engage communities across the country. If you want to organize an event for the National Teach Truth Day of Action, we have made it so easy for you to do. We have a few different kits we will mail you, and you can put it together and off you go. One of the ways to do this is get our banned books kit. It comes with several banned books and then cards that explain where that book has been banned, how it's come under attack, and what students lose when they don't get that information. And we're talking about incredible classics like The Bluest Eye from Toni Morrison, books that are life-changing and life-saving for young people, or books like All Boys Aren't Blue that talk about gender and sexuality that are just crucial for young people who are LGBTQ+. And it's easy to set up a table. You can table at a local bookstore or at a library. And as people are coming and going, you can pass out flyers about the books that are being banned, about the curriculum that's being banned, and engage them with your table. This year, we're also adding a lesson that I recently wrote for the Zen Education Project. And it begins with a gallery walk. So we'll send you all of these quotes about the history of Black education and its centrality to the Black freedom struggle. And then everyone gets post-it notes and they go around and they leave comments on each of the quotes. What does that quote mean to you? How is that quote important in the current context? And I think that people will really gain a deep understanding of the importance of the struggle for Black education. We can take a quote like the one from Carter G. Woodson. This is one of the quotes we're going to send out to people. He said, "The education of Negroes, then the most important thing in the uplift of the Negroes, is almost entirely in the hands of those who have enslaved them and now segregate them." So getting to reflect on what the quote father of Black history thought about the importance of Black education, all the way up to quotes from educators today. Somebody who is featured in my book, Teach Truth, James Whitfield, who was a principal, was pushed out in Texas. And he said, quote, "They want the curriculum to say America is not inherently racist, that America did all these things perfectly and everything is rosy and good and slavery was just a minor footnote."
Yeah.
But they've already got that. So yeah. These quotes are really going to make people think, and I am excited for that gallery walk activity.
Wow, great ideas, yeah.
And then there's one other lesson that we want people to engage in. I researched laws beginning in 1740 until today that have criminalized Black education. And then I researched what those laws were in reaction to. And so you will be given either a law or a social movement, and you have to find your match. So, for example, the law in 1740 in South Carolina that was the first law to ban Black literacy in the colonies was a reaction to the Stonewall Rebellion of 1739. It was an uprising of enslaved people.
Wow.
And they then wanted to ban literacy. And so you learn that all throughout history, every time there's been social movement fighting for justice, they've tried to ban Black studies. And then you can see that today's attack on Black studies is very similar to what those enslavers are doing.
Yeah.
And so these kind of community gatherings on the day of action, where we teach each other about history and about our community, can be really powerful. And that's really what the Zinn Education Project is all about. Get our name from the historian Howard Zinn, who wrote The People's History of the United States. And it's a history from the bottom up. It's a history that is told from the vantage point of those who have been marginalized and excluded from the corporate textbooks. And so we want to design lesson plans that are engaging and interactive, that look at U.S. history from that vantage point. So, for example, we have lessons that are free and downloadable on our website about the abolitionist movement to end slavery. Instead of just lecturing students about that movement, the students all become members of different abolitionist organizations that existed in the United States. And they research those organizations, and then they come together in a town hall meeting where they have to debate what the best methods for ending slavery should be, just as those organizations did back then. And then they compare what they came up with what the actual organizations did. And they learn that history isn't set in stone, that it didn't have to occur one way, that it was made by people who were engaged in debates.
Yeah, that history is not inevitable, that we have a shaping hand. That's so cool. So,
I love that.
So what do you say to a young teacher these days, Jesse?
That's a really good question, because there's no doubt it's a challenging time to be a teacher. And I don't want to sugarcoat that and lie to teachers and tell them that it's easy, or they should just grin and bear it and come do the right thing. It's hard. It's always been hard to be a teacher in a society that views education as a way to instill conformity rather than to unleash critical thinking. And so that That has long made education a challenging field in terms of being underfunded, undersupported, and a lack of respect. And yet all of that doesn't change the fact that being a teacher is the greatest thing you could be. It is the most incredible experience to get to see young people develop, to get to see them become who they want to be, to get to see them question society and challenge the lies that they've been told is a magical process. And when you can build a classroom where there is enough trust and love that young people know that they're supported and respected, there is no more powerful community that can be built. And I've seen it with my own eyes. And when I've done it, it has been a transcendent experience. And I'll just give one example of the magic that can come from truth teaching as an example of why I think even in these hard times, I would encourage everybody into the field of teaching. And the story I want to tell is about my first year teaching high school at Garfield High School here in Seattle. And Garfield's my alma mater. So I was excited to return to the school I went to, but I was also really nervous because when I was at Garfield, I didn't take any AP classes. I felt like they weren't for me as a Black student. I didn't see a lot of Black kids in those classes. And it felt like advanced classes were for white kids. And I internalized a lot of shame around that. And so it was hard to be in that space. And there was a lot of pressure to teach to the test and get these kids ready to pass the AP exam at the end of the year. But I resisted that because that's not who I am. And I instead used the lessons on the abolitionist movement I just described. Oh. I used a lesson on the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee you referenced earlier, right, where they all become members of SNCC, and then they have to debate the real thing SNCC debated. Should we focus on direct action campaigns like the Freedom Rides and the sit-ins, or should we focus on voter registration and getting out the vote?
Yeah.
The students debate that. Should we recruit white college students to our movement? Will they be able to relate to the rural Mississippi families that we're trying to go talk to? Or is that too hard? These are the debates the students have. And then they compare the answers that they decided on with the answers that SNCC actually decided on. We did that for every era throughout U.S. history, doing these sort of interactive lesson plans, whether it was about the women's rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the LGBTQ plus liberation movement. And at the end of the year, many of the kids ended up scoring very high on the AP exam because they loved history and it was worth it to them to study. But I told them that's not really when they passed the test. I told them that really they passed the test the following year when the state legislature voted to cut billions of dollars from the education budget. This was during the Great Recession. And a group of us teachers decided that the state cutting those billions from the schools was not only immoral, but it was illegal under our state constitution that declares education as, quote, the paramount duty of the state. And so we went to the House Ways and Means Committee meeting with a group called the Social Equity Educators. And the Occupy movement was protesting as well. They closed and locked the door, but we made it in before they locked the door. So you could hear the Occupy movement pounding on the walls on the outside. And the inside of those chambers, the teachers mic checked the room, and we disrupted their meeting where they were getting ready to cut the budget. And we read out the state constitution, and we declared that we were at the scene of a crime, and that because of that, we needed to issue a citizen's arrest of the state legislature.
Wow.
So I can't believe I did this, but I pulled out a pair of plastic handcuffs and I encouraged the legislators to come into my custody. And if you can believe it, the police officer in the chamber did not have the same interpretation of the law that I did. And instead of arresting the legislature, he arrested me. So I spent the evening in jail, and I got out and I went to school the next day, and I was pretty nervous. I was worried about what the families would think about their teacher getting arrested. But my apprehension faded quickly when a student came running up to me. This is one of the students I had taught the year before in my AP U.S. history class. And he said, "Mr. Hagopian, it worked." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I started a Facebook page called Free Mr. Hagopian. Here you are." I said, "Okay, thanks for getting me out."
Oh, man.
But then the most incredible thing happened, which is he changed the Facebook page from Free Mr. Hagopian to Walk Out Against the Budget Cuts. Oh. And in 24 hours, they organized a mass walkout at Garfield High School. They created a pamphlet that detailed what the budget cuts would do to their education. They painted all of these signs, and they had over 500 multiracial students march out of Garfield down to City Hall and demand an audience with the mayor. And he actually came out, delivered a dress from the balcony. They got their picture in the New York Times. They started a citywide movement and had another walkout that was all the high schools. And that pressure built and was part of a movement along with the unions and parent groups that within just a few weeks of those actions, the state Supreme Court ruled that we were correct and that the state legislature was going to have to add billions of dollars to the education budget in the McCleary decision. And to me, that is what the radical healing of organized remembering is all about. These students learned the history of social movements the year before. They learned that people just like them had transformed the world. And that healing allowed them to understand how to change the world themselves, that they could be agents of change. And they implemented the lessons that they had learned the very next year. And that's really what the people that I call uncritical race theorists in the book, those who are attacking anti-racist education, that's really what they fear. They know we're not shaming white kids.
Yeah.
They know that actually what we're doing is empowering white kids with the history of radical white people who joined in multiracial movements. And they fear that we are going to empower the same kind of struggles today. And they should fear that, because that's our goal.
That is absolutely the perfect note to end on, Jesse. I can't thank you enough for spending time. And these stories are so powerful because they stitch everything together in such an organic and powerful way. So thank you so much.
I can't thank you enough for having me on the show. I greatly look forward to working with you in the future and maybe even having a blues session jam sometime. I see those guitars.
Oh, yeah. You notice, man.
I'd love to play harmonica with you sometime.
We'll set that up, okay?
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Same to you. Bye.